The Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues holds doctors and researchers morally culpable for experiments involving hundreds of people in Guatemala from 1946 to 1948. During that time, a team of U.S. medical researchers infected more than 1,300 Guatemalan prison inmates, psychiatric patients, commercial sex workers, and soldiers with sexually transmitted diseases. The commission says those involved in this research violated the ethical standards not only of our time, but also of theirs. We'll talk about this report in this edition of the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. Summer McGee joins us. She is a colleague at the Center for Practical Bioethics, an expert on public health ethics and research, and she writes about the work of presidential bioethics commissions. Summer, some strong language from this report of the Bioethics Commission, and apparently well-deserved.
Yes, actually, I think that it is well-deserved. I think that what this report showed is not only was this research that we find morally reprehensible in our time, but even at that time, there were well-established standards of medical ethics, medical codes from Germany in the United States, about how doctors and doctors who work as physicians ought to behave and treat patients and subjects from a moral point of view. And this kind of research was obviously contradictory to those existing standards and the ones that we have promulgated today.
So much of this just reflects how bad this project was. But I guess a good place to start is how informed consent was abused in this process.
Well, I don't think that there was much of an informed consent process at all in any of this. It's interesting because when we think back to that period of time, and what the report shows us is that actually this wasn't just something that happened in Guatemala. The report actually starts out looking at that there was similar experiments that were happening in the prison, Terre Haute, Indiana, one of the largest prisons in the country at the time. There were significant amounts of experimentation going on there. And we know now that we do think of even the prison population as a population where informed consent and the rights of those individuals are important. And we saw consistently that there was a violation and an abuse of those populations who could easily be accessed and therefore exploited. And I think that even though the public health goals that were being pursued in this research were clearly important and necessary, they didn't give these researchers the permission to forego informed consent or any of the other ethical standards of the time.
Were the infamous Tuskegee experiments taking place at around that same time?
They were. They were taking place around that same time, continuously throughout the 1940s through the late 1960s. These experiments were taking place. This was a common practice in public health research. I think that the Public Health Service had embedded in it a certain amount of racism, a certain amount of that there were these necessary ends that needed to be met, and that meant that certain populations would need to be sacrificed for the good of scientific knowledge and for the good of public health. And I think that we now realize that, in fact, there is no public health goal or medical research goal that can justify overriding people's autonomous choice to participate in research, and that we have to respect the rights of individuals no matter how dire the circumstances may be from a health point of view.
What was it about that period of time, that era, that made this kind of research so commonplace?
I think that there were a couple of things going on. Don't forget, this was in the end of and then into the post-war era after World War II. There is always a certain sort of urgency that comes with wartime, with the desire to protect our soldiers who are away fighting for our country and preserving our rights. And I think that there's a certain amount of sacrifice that people assume will happen amongst the population at home when we have soldiers who are abroad. I think also that even though the standards of medical ethics and to a certain extent research ethics were well in place at that time, there was this idea that we could divert from those standards because of the extremity of the circumstance in the war and then the immediate immediate post-war period, because we had troops all over the world. Immediately after that, we had troops in Korea. We've had troops all over the globe, and that we needed to be able to protect them against certain kinds of diseases. And the only way we could learn how to do that was by experimenting on populations that were captive and that in large part could not resist against having experiments done on them.
Implications of Guatemala and other stories like this is that it discourages people from participating in research projects, and that can have a negative effect as well.
Absolutely. And I think that what we see that this that these findings are in some ways a vindication or a validation of the mistrust that so many different populations, particularly populations of color, have in the medical system generally and the research system most specifically. I think that unfortunately what this says is that research in the United States or sponsored by the United States government has a much longer and much darker history than what we ever realized. And probably there are many more experiments out there that just simply have not yet been uncovered, that if and when they do come to light, we will see that, in fact, these kinds of abuses were probably more commonplace than we would like to admit, and that the ongoing consequences and ramifications of the fact that this research happened will be something that we will have to work very hard in the bioethics community and the medical community for decades to come.
The Bioethics Commission report noted a tension, I think, between rules that apply ethical principles to research and bureaucratic regulations that are seen as burdensome and things to be avoided. Would it be fair to say that that's how they took a look at it?
I think it is a way that they took a look at it. I think what's important to note about this report is that they applied a very absolutist standard to the ethics of these experimentations. They did not say, as some people have argued, well, the standards for medical research were different in that time. We weren't as savvy, which I would argue we weren't as savvy about protecting research subjects as we were. I think that the governmental regulations and things that were in place in terms of allowing research to be done, particularly on soldiers, are very different now. We know that they are. But we also know that to this day, U.S. soldiers are being experimented on in programs like DARPA and others. We know the number of medical advances that currently the general population benefits from were the result of experimentation on military subjects. And so there's this difficult balance between needing to have the benefit of being able to study these populations that are captive in many ways, whether it's through enrollment in the military or through their own vulnerability, versus the need to have these kinds of medical benefits. And I think that's going to be a continuing challenge as we move forward in time. We still have vulnerable populations. We still have the need for medical advancement, and we have to find a way to balance the two without abusing one group for the benefit of another.
Still, though, Summer, what the report called for was for these regulations to have a compelling purpose, and that when you lack a compelling purpose, then it's something that makes it ripe for abuse, so to speak.
I think that even the compelling purpose language is a little bit dangerous, quite honestly. I think that if you talk to researchers back in the early 1940s, they would have said they had a compelling purpose. They had a compelling purpose to find out how they could prevent the spread of venereal disease in institutionalized populations and in the military. I think that now if you ask people who are doing research studies and clinical trials in developing countries, they would say that they have a compelling purpose to learn how most quickly and most efficiently they can develop drugs that will work for those populations in some cases, and sometimes not for those populations. Sometimes they only benefit the developed world. I think that that standard is one that will require significant refinement in order to be practically useful, because obviously there are cases when research on vulnerable populations is required. I think that the additional criteria that need to be added is that when there is that standard in place, you also need to show that it will directly benefit that population, and that ultimately the benefits and burdens will be distributed over time in a way that is fair, even though they may disproportionately burden that group in that immediate instance. We can think of wartime examples. We can think of examples of epidemics or pandemics when we may need to do clinical research that harms certain groups. But at the end of the day, we have to know that those groups are not not going to disproportionately be burdened over the long run for the benefit of the greater good of society.
The Bioethics Commission now moving forward, looking for ways, recommendations, steps to ensure that Guatemala does not happen again. What kind of things should they look at?
I think they need to look at potentially vulnerable countries where we have clinical trials running, whether they're sponsored by the federal government or whether they're privately funded. I think we need to be attuned to this notion that if there is a compelling circumstance where there is a major outbreak of a public health crisis, for example, or a need to know whether a vaccine works in a certain population, that we are very attuned to the local conditions in that population to make sure that we are not abusing them or making them more vulnerable by studying how a particular intervention might affect that group. And I think we also need to be better about partnering with other governments and other national health organizations to be sure that what we are doing is not contrary to the standards, both ethically and morally, that those other populations hold, because we do not have the market cornered on ethics. And our standards here in the Western world or the developed world even do not hold everywhere else. And so we need to be more ethically sensitive. We need to be more responsive to the needs within a particular population, and also to be respectful when those ethical standards and the needs of those populations differ from what our own goals are.
Now, you said something earlier that was a little bit scary, and that was around the idea that maybe Guatemala is only the tip of the iceberg, that there may be a lot of other circumstances that we don't know about from the era of the 40s and the 50s, and that may be going on today, as a matter of fact. And that's something that we should be aware of as well.
I think so. I mean, I think when you look at how this story unfolded, this was the result of a paper that was published by a historian from Wellesley University who looked at this particular era and uncovered just this one set of Guatemalan experiments. In the report itself, there are multiple cases, much more than just the Guatemalan experiments, that were happening at that time. And so what we see is, if we start looking through our history, I think the deeper we dig, the more we might find. And I think that we have to acknowledge that standards do change some over time, but not by this much. And I think that, you know, that doing research on prisoners back in the early 1940s, before there were research regulations about doing research on prisoners, just like with the Willowbrook studies and the Tuskegee studies, no, we didn't have fully fleshed out regulations, but we understood what vulnerability was. We understood that these were populations that could in many ways not say no to research, or were fearful that things might happen to them if they said they didn't want to participate. So we knew what right and wrong was back then. And I think that if we continue to dig, we'll find more. But I think that's not as helpful as looking forward to how we can prevent these kinds of things from happening in the future, how we can be better partners and more sensitive to the research we're doing around the world. And I think that really should be the take-home lesson from this report, that we can dig through our dirty laundry all day long, and we can find all kinds of horrible things that we've done, and we can be very sorry about that. And I think we should be aware of those mistakes we've made, and hopefully we'll learn from them. But going forward, I think we have to be sensitive to the fact that we have maybe making mistakes right now that we don't recognize automatically as mistakes. But if we were a little bit more introspective, a little bit more reflective, conversing more with our international colleagues, we might actually find that, in fact, a lot of the research that's going on now is ethically problematic as well, and that we need to be more in tune with what contemporary research ethics standards should be.
Summer McGee is with the Center for Practical Bioethics, and an expert on public health ethics and research, and she writes about the work of presidential bioethics commissions. For the complete copy of Ethically Impossible, STD Research in Guatemala from 1946 to 1948, visit bioethics.gov. That's bioethics.gov. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.